What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal tug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and this is Pacific Review, where we'll be taking a look at the top stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, Fiji moves to remove free access to surfing waves across the country. Darren Lockyer, the rugby league icon, turns to Papua New Guinea players to revive his new London club. And Solomon Islanders question police claims over shortages of vehicles. We'll have more on those stories coming up. This is Pacific Review, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. But first, surfers wanting to catch a wave in Fiji could soon have to pay for the privilege as the government moves to repeal a unique law that opened access to tourists and locals alike. Back in 2010, the surfing decree removed the exclusive rights of foreign-owned resorts to famous waves like Cloudbreak, so anyone could surf anywhere they liked. But it also removed the rights of traditional owners over their marine areas in surfing hotspots and their ability to generate income from them. The government says that's unfair, though what exactly will replace the decree remains unclear, as Liam Fox reports.
Fiji's surfing decree is a rare thing. It's one of the few laws enforced on the country during a dark period of military dictatorship that appears to have had a lasting positive impact.
We lobbied and we opened the waves in 2010, and surfers from all over the world. It was historic. People flew in, people all were celebrating.
Ian Revolvo Muller is one of Fiji's surfing pioneers. 30 years ago, he was one of the first kids to carry a board under his arm around the tourist town of Nandi. Back then, locals couldn't surf internationally renowned waves like Cloudbreak. Most tourists couldn't either.
We as locals couldn't surf, and we were treated as second-class citizens in our own country. And I mean, who would like a situation that we're in where you can't even surf your own waves?
That's because foreign-owned resorts held exclusive access rights to waves like Cloudbreak. So you had to be a guest to surf them. In 2010, the surf decree changed all that. It prohibited exclusive access rights, so anyone could surf any wave in the country without having to pay a fee or get a permit. Even critics of the then government acknowledged it helped turn Fiji into a premier surf tourism location. Ian Revolvo Muller says it also helped develop the sport of surfing in the country.
It allowed us to start surfing locals. Local businesses to start flourishing. I mean, ever since we've opened, there's been an explosion of local surf businesses and local surfers surfing. It's incredible. That's why we got all these young up-and-coming stars now, because they're able to surf the best, you know, some of the best waves in the world.
But while some locals got in on surfing-related businesses, the indigenous owners of the coastlines and seas where people were surfing could only look on as others profited. The decree removed their rights to control access to their resources. It also banned other activities from surfing areas, like fishing. The tourism minister, Bill Gavoka, says that's unfair.
No one was allowed to receive any compensation. So it denied the resource owners huge opportunities to make something out of their resources.
He says a long-foreshadowed bill to revoke and replace the surfing decree will go to Parliament next week. What exactly will replace it, though, remains unclear.
In place will be a structure that is designed to A, liberalize access to all the marine areas, and B, to ensure that the resource owners are compensated for the use of their marine areas.
Has that structure been determined yet, or is that to be developed after the legislation is in place?
It will come into Parliament next week. And it'll go through the normal process with the bills, and it'll go out to committees to hear the views of the citizenry. But fundamentally, the huge part of the equation is that when you access the marine areas, you compensate the resource owners.
How will that work? Will resource owners be able to set their own costs or set their own rates per visit? How do you think it'll work?
No, it'll be through dialogue across the board. No one will be charging anything that is out of line.
The change and lack of concrete information on what comes next is causing some concern. No one from the Fiji Surfing Association or the Fiji Hotels and Tourism Association wanted to comment, with both groups saying they don't have enough information and they're waiting to see the new law when it's tabled in Parliament. Ian Ravovo-Muller has a foot in both camps. He's a surfer who runs a surf-related business, and he has indigenous Fijian ancestry.
Our people haven't been fairly been compensated. That's been their fishing grounds. Surfers come in, they chase away the fish, they have no fish to eat. They need to be compensated. They destroy the reefs. They need to be compensated.
When the public consultations begin, Ian says he'll be floating a proposal for a way forward, a maritime version of national parks.
Having an ocean park where it's a user pay, and that money goes back into lifeguards, security, village, reef protection, making sure that, you know, the ocean and the people are looked after and it's sustainable. And it could be a great, great model for the rest of the world.
Fijian surfing pioneer Ian Ravovo-Muller ending that report from Liam Fox. Brisbane Broncos icon Darren Lockyer has taken a page out of Hollywood's playbook by buying a second-tier British rugby league club, and he's taking Papua New Guinea along for the ride. Lockyer has become the new owner of the London Broncos, and he's aiming to haul the club back into the top-flight English Super League, a feat reminiscent of Ryan Reynolds' fairy tale promotion run with the Welsh football club Wrexham FC. To spark the turnaround, Lockyer has recruited several Papua New Guinea internationals, hoping they can lift the Broncos out of obscurity. Kyle Evans with this story.
The London Broncos might be the only rugby league club in Britain to have experienced relegation before a season even began.
Of rugby league's capital club, London Broncos are booking their way back into Super League.
They just won the second-tier English Championship, effectively punching their ticket back to the top-flight English Super League. Unfortunately, it came with some bittersweet news.
We had a part-time squad, but we beat them in the grand final. Massive shock to get promoted into Super League for 2024.
Gavin Willacy is a London sports writer and long-suffering London Broncos fan.
At that exact time that they got promoted, Rugby League in Britain brought in this IMG ranking. So every club was graded a certain number of points for all the things they did on and off the field. And it basically meant that the London Broncos were going to get relegated out of Super League before they even started. So
it was another setback for the club, which had seen multiple demotions, severed ownerships, player exits and financial shortfalls over the past two decades.
There were a handful of good seasons when they were a competitive Super League side, got in the playoffs. And then every 4 or 5 years, they basically go bankrupt. And all the best players left. And there was a dreadful years of struggle and then relegation from Super League.
But for the first time in what feels like forever, Gavin is optimistic about the club's future. Brisbane Broncos icon Darren Lockyer and his business partner Grant Weschel purchased a 90% stake in the club in September. Lockyer says he aims to haul the capital out of the second-tier championship competition and back to the Super League in an ambitious plan straight out of a Hollywood playbook.
There's been a few examples happen around the world in other sports with where, you know, new ownership with some profile that sort of helps a little bit with the traction in getting people interested in the club. There's examples of it happening, and the third one, which I think was the most exciting, is like it's London. You know, London's a great city.
You know, you mentioned some of those examples, and the case study that comes to mind is Welcome to Wrexham. Was that a bit of inspiration for this project?
I think it is. Yeah, look, it's a similar concept, but we obviously don't have the same gravitas as those guys. But it's the concept's similar, right?
Lockyer doesn't have the same global reach as the actors, But his purchase comes with an advantage that Wrexham didn't have, a ready-built 9,300-seat stadium in the heart of Wimbledon. His connections have also allowed him to hire Jason Demetrio, coach of Papua New Guinea's national men's team, the Kumuls, who in turn has lured several PNG players to London to help lift the Broncos out of obscurity.
And so he's got to know these guys, and he's worked in Super League before as a player and as a coach, so he knows what's required, and he's really excited for what they can do.
Of the PNG players signed, virtually all were on the PNG Hunters list last year in the Queensland Cup. If they can succeed in London, promotion to the Super League would make an ideal stepping stone for PNG's new NRL franchise, the Chiefs. It allows Lockyer, meanwhile, to tap into a new audience of viewers in PNG's rugby league mad market, a luxury no owner before him has had access to.
A lot of people in Papua New Guinea want to watch them play, so we're in the process at the moment just trying to ensure that we can get these games streamed and then get them coming back into PNG so that they can watch their journey.
However, success is not guaranteed. The high-profile nature of Lockyer's purchase is likely to put the Broncos in the crosshairs of opposition clubs. And even if they win the premiership, the new Super League grading system dictates that commercial standards must also be met to be granted promotion. But Demetrio insists his players are up to the task.
Couldn't have said yes quick enough. They all jumped at the opportunity to come over to London and to test themselves, and it's very different from where they're from, but as I've said to them before, home will always be there.
History may also be on their side. According to rugby league journalist and historian Patrick Skeen, the UK has long been a place for PNG players to thrive.
The English have a much higher respect for PNG players. There's been 50 PNG players that have played across France and England divisions 1 and 2 since Philip Reldo in 1983 first went over there. Particularly an outpost like Hull have had at times 3 or 4 PNG players there.
Broncos superfan Gavin is also hopeful. After watching fan attendance dwindle to less than 500 people in recent years, he's hopeful Lockyer's gamble will pay off.
There is an enthusiasm. It's, you know, anyone who cared about them is interested again now.
London-based sports writer and London Broncos superfan Gavin Woolsey ending that report from Kyle Evans. Pacific seasonal workers in Australia are being advised to stay vigilant and not share their personal details with anyone. It follows an alert issued by the Commonwealth Bank warning about scams targeting seasonal workers. Simon Birmingham, CEO of the Australian Banking Association, told Lucy Cooper that workers are particularly vulnerable.
Australia's banks are always on the lookout for scams that might be ripping off all of their customers, be they Australian citizens, seasonal workers or others banking through the Australian banking system. And Commonwealth Bank have recently identified particular risks in relation to dodgy loan or credit scams where seasonal workers, palm scheme workers are being trapped into potentially providing upfront payments for loans, giving away account details. The type can see them lose money for products that definitely are not coming from banks and for people who are only pretending to be acting on behalf of banks.
What kind of scams would traditionally target seasonal workers?
We see with these types of loan or credit scams is that Pacific workers are being asked to provide upfront payments and application fee for loans, which they shouldn't be facing, that they are being asked to give away certain account access details, which nobody should ever do, and that they are potentially sometimes even still being lumbered with credit products and loans that are not wise for them to have, or that they don't actually know about, because by giving away information, people are then going and writing these loans on their behalf without their knowledge.
Are seasonal workers considered to be a more vulnerable group or more at risk of being scammed?
Any one of us can potentially be scammed, and we see Australians and people all around the world of all educational standards and backgrounds being scammed. But certainly lower levels of financial literacy, less exposure to banking products and how loans and credit facilities work increase the risk that that somebody may be scammed. In the case of Pacific workers and Palm Scheme workers, the risk there is that they may not have had that same exposure, are unlikely to, in fact, of more sophisticated banking products, of how Australian banks work and of credit schemes. And that means that unscrupulous people can come along and are coming along and targeting these workers, trying to get them to sign up to processes where it's sold as you can get more money faster. And that more money faster, though, is either a complete scam or entrapping people in loans that they don't really need and wouldn't necessarily want if they fully understood it.
What tips do you have for seasonal workers to avoid being scammed?
People need to be really careful to avoid using unknown agents or brokers who just approach them out of the blue. If they need financial support, to make sure they are going through upfront with banks or through other trusted sources in terms of their PALM employers and coordinators who can help them. And that PALM workers, just like everybody else, should never be giving away or providing internet banking passwords, one-time codes, or any access to their accounts for other people to get into those bank accounts.
Simon Birmingham, Chief Executive Officer of the Australian Banking Association, and he was speaking there to the ABC's Lucy Cooper. In Papua New Guinea, the government is warning that domestic violence has become a national crisis. A new report found more than 60% of women have been abused by their partners, more than double the global average. It also found reports of gender-based violence have increased by a staggering 210% in the past 4 decades. As the government finalizes a new 10-year plan to combat the issue, PNG correspondent Marion Farr speaks with people on the front line. And a warning, this story may be distressing to some listeners.
Fiona has been with her second husband for more than 7 years. For safety reasons, she's not using her real name. She says the abuse started early in their relationship.
He keeps weapons nearby, a long machete, rubber hose and belt. He puts it near the lamp and sleeps. If we don't have sex, he hits me. If I refuse sex, he hits me.
Poverty and his controlling behaviour have kept her trapped in the cycle of violence and physical abuse.
He would lock the door so I cannot get out.
It's impacted her and her youngest son.
When other children would eat ice cream or soft drinks or chew lollies, I would take my son away. I don't want him to see them and beg them to share.
While harrowing, Fiona's experience isn't unique in Papua New Guinea, where gender-based violence has been declared a national crisis. Shirley Cowper runs a safe house in the capital, Port Moresby, and says the issue is getting worse.
The escalation of violence is going like 100 steps ahead of us.
A new government report sponsored by the UN found rates of domestic violence have increased by 210% in the past 4 decades. It also found 64% of women in 2025 experienced intimate partner violence, more than double the global average. Shirley Cowper says across PNG, frontline services like hers are underfunded and overwhelmed.
Even though we don't have money, we don't have budget, we don't have resources, but at least we can provide you something.
Another example is the Police Family and Sexual Violence Unit. Its budget for this year was just $100,000 for the entire country to cover both wages and operations. Shirley says that's clearly not enough.
Policemen or a woman that works in the FSVU, there may be 2 and 3 in the FSVU, and you are looking at almost 100 survivors coming a day, and they are burnt out.
Fiona says she reported her husband to police once.
There was a time he came after drinking and beat me up with a metal rod.
He was arrested, she says, but bailed himself out and the police didn't follow up.
He came back and continued to beat me. He got close to me, continued the assault.
PNG police did not respond to the ABC's request for comment. The PNG government is now reviewing a new 10-year strategy aimed at reducing gender-based violence, which will cost $65 million annually. Powers Parkop is the chair of PNG's Permanent Parliamentary Committee for Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment, which has been driving the strategy. He says key reforms include bolstering police, building more safe houses, programs for perpetrators, and better coordination of funding.
If we put all the funding together through the GBV Secretariat, then they will monitor it and make sure that it's having impact.
That's after the last 10-year strategy failed to meet its objectives, partly due to government funding delays. Shirley Cowper says that must not happen again.
We want the leadership to be improved. We want the budget to be permanent.
In Solomon Islands, there's calls for answers over how hundreds of police vehicles, including those donated by Australia, are being used. Frustrated residents in the capital, Honiara, say they've been left hanging with no response to their emergency calls. As the ABC's Chris and Rita Amanu Leong reports, it comes as Australia tries to build up its security ties with the Solomons.
When Abraham Ilala's home in Honiara was broken into, his immediate reaction was to call 999. That's the police emergency number.
I called once, twice, no one picked up.
At the third attempt, a police officer picked up.
What answer? No, to wait, no any vehicle.
I relayed the incident, but what she told me came as a shock. She said, sorry, we don't have any vehicles to assist.
Stories like this are familiar across the country. One Honiara magistrate even complained about the excuses made by police over vehicle shortages. It prompted anti-corruption group Transparency Solomon Islands to look deeper into the issue.
The public needs to know, why is their police force not able to respond to their needs when they have been given all of these vehicles? Yeah?
That's Ruth Lilokula, Transparency Solomon Islands CEO.
Resources that they have been given, yeah? But the other question is, when the development partners give us vehicle, what is the government's support to them? How much fuel are they giving the police? And then the other thing is, what is allocated to what?
The police force has received vehicle and equipment donations from the governments of Australia and China since 2022. Public records show over 100 police vehicles were donated in the last 3 years alone. On the streets of the capital, Honiara, there are questions on whether the donations are helping law enforcement.
Nothing has really changed.
It feels the same.
Me looking for something change.
Yes, but only small changes, not really noticeable.
No big number.
It is unclear how many police vehicles are currently in use across the country and whether there is still a shortage of vehicles. The ABC put questions to the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force, and this was their response.
The Commissioner has decided not to respond to your request, seeing the security nature of the vehicle allocations.
This response comes in the same week as the arrest of a police officer for allegedly drink driving in a police vehicle. There's also a social media outcry over a photo of people drinking in a police vehicle. And all of this comes as Australia tries to cement its position as the number one security partner by backing a plan to increase the size of the police force. Transparency's Ruth Lilokula says the response by the RSIPF is strange.
It is a security matter for them, but it is also a security and safety matter for the citizens too. So whose security are they talking about? The security of the officers? The security of the vehicles? Or the security of what?
Back in Honiara, Abraham Ilala says he wants a police force that can not only restore public confidence, but also turn up.
I only want police stations to have the vehicles readily available to attend any urgent call-outs.
Police must come now.
Abraham Ilala, a Honiara resident, ending that report by the ABC's reporter in Solomon Islands, Christian Rita Omanu-Leong. This is Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening. Please join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific.